The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
And you're very welcome to the show. And listen, if you want to put manners on yourself, if we needed manners putting us at this stage, the Sunday Independent has a very striking picture on the front of Maria Liston, 78, from Foynes, treated for COVID at University Hospital Limerick. And she's looking out at us. It's like those ads they've started doing in England. Look me in the eye and tell me you're doing everything you can to stop COVID. She's looking out at us from behind a mask there. And there's a very good report inside from Wayne O'Connor. So they're leading with fighting for our lives. People need to see what's going on. It's like a war zone. That's what the medics in Limerick University Hospital are saying. So Hugh O'Connell and Maeve Sheehan are in this story as well. They're saying, you know, the AstraZeneca vaccines, they're saying that we will get 1.1 million doses instead of 1.4 million. Now, they don't give the time scale on that, but I think I saw the Minister for Health saying the other day, 200,000 a month. So I think that's 1.1 million over the next 7 months. I was trying to ask the Taoiseach this yesterday. I can't see right now how every adult in the country is vaccinated by September, because that's 7 million doses of a two-dose vaccine. So that's 1 million a month, practically. So I'm just not sure how that works. I think they're counting in Johnson & Johnson there. And Johnson & Johnson more and more becomes the game changer now, I think. The Business Post, critical care capacity, as Martin warns of restrictions to last month. And they're again saying vaccination rollout suffers real setback. I see Giuseppe Conte in Italy. The Italians are saying they'll sue AstraZeneca. They're saying he entered into contracts freely with us, and you are now destroying our vaccine rollout, and we will sue you to get what we need. The Taoiseach did say here yesterday that there will be very robust conversations with AstraZeneca, so we'll see what comes of that. The Sunday Times Northern Irish back border poll within 5 years. So there's a slim majority for a border poll, but in fact then there is a slim majority who favour staying in the UK when they actually ask people how they would vote. So it's 53-47. It's a bit like America, half and half. And we know half and half is never a good thing, as we're seeing in America. And they also have on the front page of the Sunday Times, government divided over quarantine for foreign travellers. So obviously this is the big clamour at the moment now is people seal the borders and all that kind of thing and zero COVID and everything. But they're saying here the Taoiseach is expected to meet resistance from Fine Gael and Green Party leaders tomorrow on his plan for, and this is only limited hotel quarantine, that's for anyone coming in without a negative test. Leo Varadkar did say last week there that he thinks mandatory quarantine is disproportionate. The Irish Mail on Sunday, quarantine all arrivals, warn medics. And that is, you know, there's a big movement there among some in the scientific community, the zero COVID people, the Independent Scientific Advice Group, I think they're called. Big push there as well for them now saying, you know, zero COVID's where it's at. The Sunday Mirror, grounded, and they're talking about 6 months of hard lockdown, etc. I don't think it's quite 6 months of hard lockdown, 6 months of restrictions. I think the Taoiseach was at pains to say he doesn't mean a lockdown for 6 months. But there's a picture of cars at the airport, Gardaí checking cars at Dublin Airport yesterday. And you will note that the Taoiseach did mention yesterday a lot of the people coming into Dublin Airport, it's clearly felt, are Irish people coming back from holiday homes, etc. And that is one thing that they seem to want to cut out. The Sun on Sunday, a bit of light relief. So Maura Higgins, you remember Maura Higgins from Love Island, Maura Higgins wants to get married. Chris better hurry up and give me that engagement ring because I'm not getting any younger, says Maura. Now, look, Maura, I don't know you, but now is not a good time for anyone to be planning a wedding. But I just feel in my bones that this particular wedding, don't plan that particular wedding at the moment with you and your whoever that guy is. And the Sunday World, kids fight cab for slain dad's cash. Gardaí face legal battle after they seize money and gun and car from gun victim. Gibson. So look, lots to chew over today. And our panel in studio, Kate O'Connell, pharmacist and former Fine Gael TD is here, as is Jack Horgan-Jones, journalist with the Irish Times. And safely socially distanced from us on the line is Dr. Jack Lambert, consultant in infectious diseases at the Mater Hospital and UCD. Jack, can I go to you first? And we're seeing a lot of frightening scenes from hospitals and ICU. And I have to say, reading that piece in the Sunday Independent, what your colleagues are going through and a year into it now and burnt out and everything else and how sick people are and everything, it's all, it's very sobering, isn't it?
It absolutely is, you know. But the reality is we went through this in March and April, you know, the Dublin hospitals and a few hospitals outside of Dublin, and we're going through it again, but every hospital in the country has been affected, including some hospitals that never saw it in the first wave. So yes, it is sobering. We went through this. I take COVID very seriously. But the other side of the coin is that the good news for me, as we don't always want to kind of communicate Armageddon, is that the numbers in the community are flattening. The new admissions to the hospital are flattening over the country. But the ICUs are going to continue to be stressed for the next couple of weeks, because once you're in the ICU, you stay there for 2 weeks, and one more admission, one more admission, one more admission, it kind of increases the stress. But I think the HSC has done a really good job of preparing for this, at least the acute care hospital surge. And I think we just need to kind of applaud everybody on the front line and applaud the ICU staff. And I think we will get through it. So I think there has to also be a communication of hope, not just Armageddon and dismay.
Okay, how are things in the matter?
Right, well, we like everybody else have been challenged, but like I said, I think we're like I said, it's not Armageddon. I think some other hospitals have been even more challenged than we have this time around. But all hospitals are being challenged, especially the ICUs, including the ICU, the Mater are being challenged, and we kind of have to applaud all of our, healthcare workers who are taking that challenge. And I think just a couple more weeks, as long as the numbers in the community continue going down, we won't see another surge, I pray and I hope and I predict. But I think it really depends upon the community as well to take this seriously and not keep on spreading the virus, because that will result in more in the hospital, more in the ICU.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, without making people complacent, you feel that we might again just squeeze through here without overwhelming the health system.
I think absolutely. I think the government reacted well when they saw the numbers going back up around Christmas, going back into lockdown. And I think most of the Irish public responded appropriately and took it seriously. I think we let up a little bit around Christmas, but I think, I think this is a very unforgiving virus. I don't think we should be blaming people. We should be applauding people and encouraging people to continue to do the right thing.
Okay. Kate O'Connell, you were looking at that piece as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's frightening to see the actual pictures of what's going on, members of our communities with masks on them requiring oxygen support. And it seems to take this sort of image for people to realise the huge impact and this is now having. I'm working in a community pharmacy, and the narrative now is that everybody knows somebody that has COVID or somebody that's very sick at home with COVID. I hope that Dr. Lambert is correct in that the figures are going down. But in terms of what we're seeing in the community, is there's a huge amount of people at home with COVID, people that are on prescriptions from their GPs, people with inhalers, and they're getting sick 2 and 3 weeks into this. So I would be concerned about the cumulative effect on A&E, the cumulative effect on ICU, but also where we're going. So I think the next few weeks are critical, and I think it's really important that with the evidence showing the increased transmissibility at about 1.4 times the original variant that we were dealing with, I think we just have to ramp things up and get those figures down to where they should have been brought before Christmas, down to below 100 cases, so that the baseline from which we're working off to grow exponentially is low, so therefore we can contain this disease. We need to start containing this. What has been done so far, I think we all have to admit, isn't working.
Yeah, okay. So on that, containment. And I mean, I think Jack Horgan-Jones, a lot of people asking questions now, and we maybe come to it in a minute about, like, can you actually contain this at all? But the big discussion that's going on in the country now, there's been this kind of real upsurge now in, I think, definitely there's a populist view among the public that are demanding that we have, some of them, the more vocal, demanding mandatory quarantine, kind of for everyone coming into the country in a way. Where is it at politically, do you think?
So I think that there is, it's one of those situations where the population is kind of ahead of the government on this, you know, and that's never really a good position for the government to be in. You know, the people who are being governed shouldn't be dictating or suggesting the policy choices for the government themselves. That's not a good position for cabinet to be in at all. I think that we will likely see on Monday and Tuesday of the coming week, some form of increased restrictions on travel coming in. I think that the worm has turned on that, and it's something that the state has been resistant to for a long time. Going back to, I mean, not just this year or the second wave, but going all the way back to May and June of last year, there were proposals coming from the National Public Health Emergency Team on mandatory quarantine, which went to cabinet, which were rejected. And they were rejected for, broadly speaking, kind of good reasons. You know, I mean, the border is not a small problem. The idea that it's easy to decide who you quarantine coming in, under what powers and where you put them is a small thing, is not true. But I think part of the problem is that the state and the government never really kind of thought very seriously about these issues. They just said, these are the problems, these are the reasons why we can't do it, and therefore we're not doing it. And now we're in a situation where very much so the public mood is there, the dissonance between...
Well, as far as we know, the public mood is there. I mean, we're...
Yeah, sure, look at the polling last weekend. You know, I mean, there was a poll in the Mail on Sunday last weekend which said 90% of people would be very much in favour of mandatory hotel quarantine.
For everyone coming into the country.
I'm not sure exactly what the question was, but some form of enhanced mandatory hotel quarantine. And I, just for everyone coming into the country, I don't think we're going to end up there immediately. But I do think that in kind of short enough order, we will be looking at a situation where certainly those who are coming in without a PCR test, and perhaps those coming in from hotspots where there's new variants emerging.
That looks like the first step.
That looks like the kind of toe in the water. Moment. Figure out how this might work. Figure out the big moving parts.
Yeah. Kate, I suppose, like, it's very easy for us all to think, yes, you know, the safest thing to do now is quarantine everyone coming into the country. But, like, I think we're talking about 30,000 or so a week people coming in at the moment. Now, presumably that would go down with a quarantine. If they're quarantined for 2 weeks in a hotel somewhere, that's 60,000 people potentially at any one time. And then as Niall Conroy, the Irish public health doctor in Australia, is pointing out, you have to do it really, really. It has to be tight. Otherwise, you're just wasting a load of time with it. It has to be perfect. Like,
yeah, I have a sister. Fairly extreme, I have a sister, a doctor in Perth. So yeah, they're doing this, and I understand how hard it is to do it. But I do think that eventually the government will be dragged kicking and screaming towards a zero COVID island, and they will have to put in a border. And the idea of can't isn't cutting any mustard anymore. Yeah. And the border that exists in Ireland is only a political border at the minute. So I cannot see why at this point we cannot set our differences aside, because we will not have a future if we don't sort this out. So I'm in favour of, if they don't like the border where it is, and if it's fraught with such difficulty, let's get a crayon and draw a new border, be it around the two islands. I was saying to your researcher earlier, if we could kind of include maybe one of the Canary Islands, it'd be handy as well. Yeah, so maybe we could go on holidays, maybe Iceland up at the top as well. But leaving that aside, we're going to have to close borders. We're going to have to put in a border. We're going to have to ultimately work with the UK. It's going to be unpalatable for many. I see the emergence of terms such as British Isles in the last week, which many people would find, and I would find, very offensive. But I don't want to use that term, but some sort of socially distanced temporary arrangement that we'll have to get into bed with the Brits and get over our irreconcilable differences for the sake of the welfare of our country.
And look, it does seem that this two island strategy is being seriously discussed.
But why is it so hard to make the right decisions? Why is it so hard to do what's best for our people? And why has it been so hard since the start for policymakers to follow the expert advice? It looks like we've spent a year going around in circles.
Well, I think they would argue because they were trying to keep an economy going. But I guess really a lot of people thinking at this stage, Jack, that if Jack Lambert, a lot of people thinking now, Jack, that if this is the alternative, endless lockdowns, and you come out of them briefly and off it goes again, that we possibly do need to seal the island.
Well, you know, I think if you do it right, like New Zealand, it works. Like Singapore, it works. But we're not Singapore, we're not New Zealand. We have this Northern Ireland border, and we've been talking about this for 9 months. And I think we need to think of a way, what can we practically do over the next 6 months? You know, COVID calmed down in the summer last year. I'm hoping it does it again this year. It's a seasonal virus. The vaccine's coming along. That's going to give us, you know, the herd immunity. So, yes, we have to think about all the things we can do to suppress COVID. And if that's an achievable, if you think that's going to be achievable and you want to put all your, you know, eggs into that basket, then we should do that. But I think it's going to be a huge challenge to get agreement on, you know, kind of mandatory, you know, kind of cutting off the country 100%, you know, quarantine of everybody flying into the country, quarantine of everybody that puts their foot across the Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland border. You need to do a test when you cross the border, you know, from one side to the other. I mean, it's going to be a huge challenge to do. So, yes, we do need to think about what would work for Ireland. But I'm still skeptical that a zero COVID Ireland strategy is going to be rolled out successfully. I think it's going to be delays, discussions, arguments.
Yeah.
I think we have to.
Now, let's get a broader perspective on this. Martin McKee is the Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and he's on the line. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
Martin, you are quoted in a piece with Daniel Byrne in the Business Post today, and you're making the very simple point that, say, living with COVID, which is our stated strategy in this country, you say that that's actually impossible. It makes no sense to try and keep this contained.
Well, for a whole series of reasons. First of all, we know that we can actually achieve elimination of domestic transmission because lots of countries have done it. And, you know, Australia...
We've done it ourselves.
Talk about. Yeah, you got it right down during the summer as well. So it can be done, and it can be done even in places where there have been high rates, like in Victoria in Australia. But above all, we cannot go forward with this constant uncertainty where it is impossible to book a summer holiday, to arrange a wedding, to do any of the things that you need to do months in advance when you don't know what will be possible. And if I could pick up one of the things that one of your speakers said there about this being a seasonal virus, tell that to the people in South Africa who are currently in the middle of their summer and it's raging through. The reason that this virus and these waves have come and gone has been entirely because of the policies that have been adopted by governments. It's not about seasonality. Any seasonal
and it was winter when they eliminated it down in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I know there is dispute about that. Listen,
About what? Sorry.
There is dispute, isn't there? Like, people would dispute the assertion that it's seasonal, don't they? That is too early to say. Yeah.
There is very little evidence that it's seasonal, actually. Any seasonal impact is quite small and probably related to the human behaviour that that goes with the seasons themselves.
Yeah. Martin, there's a broader issue here, there's something very attractive about zero COVID because people hear normal life and everything. But there's an even more exciting notion here that Angela Merkel has floated, which is that she wants the EU to be considered as one epidemiological region, that if we all coordinated our strategy, and you agree that obviously it's ambitious, but look, everything's ambitious now. You agree this could be a way to go, and that would actually allow us all to travel around Europe. Is that right?
Of course. The thing is that there is no reason to have a boundary, a health boundary between two entities that have got the same very low levels, and that's already happening within some of the Australian states and between New Zealand and Australia and between New Zealand and the Pacific Islands. So you can remove those problems at the border. You obviously have a situation in the islands off the coast of Europe, and I heard your discussion earlier, whatever we want to call them. There is the situation with Great Britain versus the island of Ireland. But obviously, as we already do for animal health, you would be having to treat the island of Ireland as one single health unit. And that's been established for animals for decades. So you just continue with that.
But you are saying that you think that it should be doable, that basically the whole of Europe, including Ireland and the UK, becomes one bubble, becomes Australia, if you will, and that we all live within a zero COVID Europe, yes?
Well, of course, the Great Britain, the United Kingdom, is no longer part of the European Union. So
How did I forget that?
So if we're talking about the island of Ireland, with the Northern Ireland still in, it's functionally within the European Union in many respects, then of course it's entirely possible. But it does require concerted action, and it does require each of the member states to give up some degree of their individual decision making. And Ursula von der Leyen has called for a European Health Union. There's now a lot of support among the member states because they've seen the necessity for that. The only thing that held us back up until now was that member states were reluctant to give up control of their health systems. But I think now we're moving beyond that.
Yeah, and having seen how weak Europe's response was on health at the beginning of all this, I think a lot of people are rethinking that. Martin.
Of course, the member states, remember, it's not the European Union, not the European Commission, it's the member states that have held the powers to themselves. So coming together will overcome many of those problems.
Okay, Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Thank you very much for that. Now, listen, guys, we thought a zero COVID Ireland was an attractive idea. A zero COVID Europe is an extremely attractive idea, isn't it? But like straight away, you think we're never going to manage that, Kate.
Well, like that, we're past can't at this stage.
Yeah.
This virus has proven that, although we were told from the start that it grows exponentially, that and that it's capable of evolving and getting ahead. We have been behind this virus since the start. We had light in October, November with the development of the vaccines. But even now, I think it's dawning on people that the vaccine itself is not this magic solution. It's not a magic cure to COVID. It's just part of the solution. I think what we have learned in recent months that is for every political inaction, there is a COVID reaction, and that's what's driving the cycles of surge. It's, as the last speaker said, it's human behaviour, congregation, the partying at Christmas, and all of that. So we have to, I suppose, cop on to ourselves a year in, look at our mistakes from the past, from the past year, and work with our European partners to try and have some sort of sustainable future that isn't restricted, because people are withered. And the when you see the front of the Indo and the staff working in that environment, there's only so much staff can take. There's only so much staff in supermarkets can take, and there's only so much staff in community pharmacies can take. Many of the people working on the front line in terms of serving customers in supermarkets have dealt with an enormous amount of hardship and abuse over the last year, and also trying to balance that with their personal lives in terms of having immunocompromised family members, in terms of tracing, in terms of going on to the PUP payment, in terms of the instability. And I often wonder how many people actually in jobs like that have still got up in the morning and gone to work, because it's increasingly challenging. And I think putting another year of that in front of people is just not acceptable. We need to mind people, and the strongest and best of people I have seen wither in front of me in the last fortnight. And I think we all have to accept the fact that we're humans and that we have feelings and emotions, but we don't expect, and I don't expect my policy makers to be making decisions based on emotions and feelings. Okay. I want them to base it on science and fact.
A texter says Australia and New Zealand have abandoned, and And by the way, the Taoiseach was at pains to point out yesterday that the public health advice has never been to go for zero COVID Ireland. Texter here says, Australia and New Zealand have abandoned their citizens living abroad. Many Aussies can't get home at all, even with the quarantine, as flights are restricted so much because obviously limited number of places in quarantine hotels. This type of policy will mean citizens abroad won't make it home when they actually have to fly. For example, for a funeral or to see a dying relative. We have a huge diaspora. They're citizens of Ireland too. We can't just abandon them. Jack Organ-Jones, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I think the point that Kate makes is an excellent one. And I think that it's felt not only, although it is felt more acutely, obviously, in those in frontline positions, but I think there's a wider kind of despondency in society at the moment. And I think that that is kind of tied to the fact that in the current lockdown, I mean, there's no real kind of roadmap out of it. I mean, we have this kind of vague idea that we'll vaccinate everyone and we'll come out of it at some point after the middle of the year. But like, there's no kind of laddered approach to it. It's not as if on X date we're going to be able to go and see our parents, then on Y date we might be able to go out and see each other in restaurants, you know. So I think that that kind of sense of there being no clear line on the horizon,
I don't think you can.
And I think that's why there's a kind of move towards a new kind of paradigm or a new framework for pandemic policy. And I think that's where a lot of the support for zero COVID or something
that,
like zero COVID is coming from.
Feel there'd be some certainty
exactly.
There.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the risk on travel though as well is that, you know, we'll be left behind effectively. Europe will move in this direction. The UK will move in this direction. And then, you know, we're talking about travel bubbles and that, I think that's some way off. I think there's a more pressing reason to move on travel sooner rather than later, and that is the arrival of these variants, you know. I mean, we lost the battle against B117, the UK variant, before we even knew we were in a battle, you know, and if we were, and that's forgivable to some extent, but if we were to allow a situation where new variants come in and complicate the picture even further, I think the political cost of that would be enormous, because this time we are forewarned of just how quickly you can lose control of a variant and how that can have an impact on how the disease behaves and the mortality rates.
Jack Lambert, would you agree there that this idea of living with COVID and keeping it contained in some way, as Martin McKee says, it just can't happen, because as soon as you let up, every time, it doubles, it quadruples, and off it goes exponentially again?
Well, I don't think we have a choice. I think we have to live with COVID while we come up with some plan. And for example, I think one of the messages that I haven't seen in any of the papers today is now that we're in lockdown, what are we doing to prepare for getting out of lockdown? So, you know, like, for example, with the schools and stuff, you know, I mean, how are we enhancing what we're doing in the community to minimize spread of this virus and spread of this even more infectious virus? You know, I think we need to there needs to be an educational message out there. There needs to be support for, you know, enhancing the current precautions. So, yes, we do need to wait for a vaccine, but we need to do a lot of stuff in parallel with the vaccine rolling out. We don't have control of how much vaccine is coming, when it's going to come. That is the light at the end of the tunnel. But whether it's a zero COVID strategy or how do we live with COVID? You know, so for example, I would say I go out to the community and I would say, you know, most people still walking into stores aren't washing their hands, going out of stores aren't washing their hands, disinfection, sanitation. You know, I think we need to, in parallel with all this, you know, zero COVID rolling out the vaccine, we need to kind of have enhanced COVID prevention strategies, you know, out there training people every day, because I see so many cases of COVID in low-risk individuals. You know, I mean, that people who are doing mostly the right things who just make one or two mistakes, you know. So this is a very unforgiving virus. So I think another message we need to get out there is the enhanced precautions, the COVID prevention, so that when people can't live 100% in their house, they do have to venture out. How can you venture out safely? How can you open up safely? This has to be part of the message that needs to be in the papers on a daily basis.
Yeah. I think, Jack, nobody is in any kind of space or form to think about how we might open up safely now, because we got burnt so badly there at Christmas, I think. A lot of you are suggesting names now for this new version of the UK, the two island strategy. So instead of British Isles, is one texter, the Anglo-Celtic Isles, the Western Europe Isles. Somebody else is saying the Wise Isles, Wales, Ireland, Scotland and England. Yeah, that's Liam in Donegal. Liam far from wise at the moment. There is an important email here from John, lest we forget. He says, unless the government includes financial support for Irish Airlines as part of any restrictions, we'll all be swimming off this island for our next holiday. 2 summers of lost earnings are not sustainable for many in the travel industry. And indeed, like, I can understand why the chief medical officer is giving out to Ryanair for advertising, you know, get your job and go on a flight and everything. But, like, we will want these guys when it's over. And at the moment, like, they don't have a business model, you know. So we do want our connectivity, as they say, to be there at the end. Now, let's talk about schools and Annie Curtis, who's an immunologist at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland and a parent, is on the line. Annie, how are you?
How are you doing, Brendan?
So, Annie, you're wearing two hats here. As an immunologist, do you think it's realistic for the schools to reopen in the next few weeks?
Well, no, I don't think so with the level of community transmission as high. Just even as a parent, like, if you look at how long it's taken us to bring down the numbers from, let's say, the start of January to now, we've another way to go. And I think a lot of parents, even though they were holding out hope that we might be open in, that the schools might be open in February, probably knew sort of in the pit of their stomachs that that may not be the case. And I think that's what Micheál Martin is alluding to when he's talking about maybe a reopening by March.
Yeah. Okay. So look, yeah, I think people understand it in one way, but it doesn't take away. I think people were a bit shocked yesterday to hear March mentioned, because I suppose we do keep deluding ourselves. You've described your own experience of homeschooling. It means that you're never off, basically.
Well, yeah, I know, Brendan, I would say, you know, we are really lucky in one way in that both of us still have our jobs. And I know there's a lot of people who just don't
Absolutely.
Have their jobs.
Goes without saying.
But certainly, yeah, there's just not enough hours in the day, because, you know, your role now has become from being parent to now being teacher and friend, you know, to your children. Like, we have two, a 6 and a 7-year-old. And, you know, their needs definitely depend on their age, you know, depending on which class they are in. But yeah, you're trying to juggle your home. One of you is homeschooling in the morning and while the other parent is working. Then in the afternoon, the parent who was working is either homeschooling or trying to, you know, get them out of the house, get a bit of exercise. And then in the evening time, then a lot of the times, and certainly in our case, we're back working again because, you know, we haven't been able to do our full day's work during the day. Now, I know a lot of companies and certainly the company, or RCSI, who I work for, are very, you know, understanding of that. But yeah, there just isn't enough hours.
But listen, whatever about us poor beleaguered parents, this is very hard on little kids as well, isn't it?
It really is. Like, their whole social network has just been taken away. They really miss their friends. And I think, you know, children really thrive with routine, and that's been taken away from them as well. You know, the structure of the schools are amazing. And just their interactions with their own friends. You know, they love their teachers so much. They're not getting the face-to-face time with them. And, you know, it's hard for them, especially, you know, our two are 6 and 7. It's just really hard for them to understand what's going on, you know, with these these rolling lockdowns. It's hard enough for us to understand them. But, you know, for little ones, it's an extra difficulty for sure.
OK, listen, Annie, you probably have work and school and all kinds of things to do, so I'll let you go. Thanks very much, Annie, and talk to you soon.
Take care, Brendan. Bye-bye.
Jack Lambert, you picked out a piece in the Sunday Independent, Fighting for Our Lives. The school reopening piece in the Sunday Independent, the battle to get back into our classrooms.
Yeah, the battle to get back into classrooms. And like I said, I mean, I have a teenage son who's, you know, one year away from his leaving cert. And
okay. How's right he doing?
Now, the reception's not good, so he just has to call by phone. And he struggled when school was, when he was actually in the classroom. Now that he's out of the classroom, it's even more of a struggle. And, you know, I think it's absolutely the right decision not to go back to schools right now, but let's look at the target of going back in March. You know, I think we have to have a think about what are we going to put into place right now in anticipating, after St. Patrick's Day, opening up of the schools, if that's going to be a plan.
And what do we need to put in place, Jack?
Well, I think we have to think about everything. We have to think about vaccinating, staff at risk who are going to be the staff, taking care of these kids when they go back to school. I've got serious concerns. Just recently, I know of two, daycares that have got COVID in them. Last year, I knew of no daycares, but two daycares currently I know have limited daycares are opened right now, and two of them I personally know have COVID in them.
Among children as well as the workers?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And that, so that makes you kind of worry that if we open up schools, if we open up daycares, this virus is even more infectious, even more transmissive. So the current precautions we have in the community are not good enough. So we have to think about now, more sanitation, more hand washing, maybe higher level PPE that we need to have for staff. A lot of staff that in my son's school, according to my son, were just wearing visors, not masks. Do we need to think about higher quality medical masks? We need to start thinking about that now in anticipation of March. We're not going to have zero COVID in Ireland by the middle of March. And if we open up the schools and the daycares unsafely, they'll be closed down again in a week. Mm. And looking at this article, the special needs parents, that they're devastated by the kids not going back to school. The rug was pulled from under us in a very cruel way. That's what it says. And, I'm very sympathetic to that. But I'm just thinking, how can we make it safe so that when the schools do open up again, they can stay open?
Yeah. When you hear Phil Nihay yesterday telling Katie Hannan that they can't even get the upgraded medical masks that are now recommended, well, the HSE says they can get them, but she's saying they're not there. You'd wonder, are we going to get good PPE for teachers as well? Kate, what do you think about what Jack is saying there about thinking about vaccinating some education workers? Is it starting to crystallise that if that is the most essential? I know everyone has a claim to move up
I'd be reluctant to start interfering with the programme, because every time you hear a group, you go, God, they should be done. So there's always somebody. But I do think when it comes to the special needs assistance, I think you're looking at a different balance of risk. You're looking at a different scoring mechanism here, because there are so many other things that are going on. There's, I have a 5-year-old and she's supposed to be in junior infants. She spent very little time in it. But I can see how you could manage her in a classroom because she can self-care. Mm. But if you're dealing with a child with special needs, there's no way of dealing with their intimate care needs without getting within 2 metres. And obviously, there's an understanding issue. In terms of what Jack is saying about, living with COVID, he's so right in that the basics need to be adhered to, and the high-grade masks. I mean, I've worn one since the start. I've been able to get them since the start, and there are supplies available. Now, they are expensive. You're probably looking at about €1 each, if I'd say the state was buying them in bulk, as opposed to, normal grade masks or, cents at this stage. But there's also something that I think we haven't done. We haven't looked at living with COVID in terms of what other things we can be doing. So, we have a patient cohort coming in for testing all the time. Is there scope to eliminate other diseases, perhaps, while we have, we're looking at?
Like what?
Well, hepatitis is one example. Do we need to look at the burden, perhaps, of HIV in our community? When we have people in having tests and serological tests, are we genotyping for other viruses that are maybe out there in the community? Can we be doing scientific things in tandem with the testing at the minute? And also in terms of, are we going to look at that cohort of, so I have a kid of 10 and 8 as well. I would be concerned about my 10-year-old because he's going into fifth class. And if this continues for a couple of years, maybe in rolling knockdowns, do we need to start looking at perhaps a seventh class, a catch-up class that would be
because they need the basics of the reading, writing and certain maths basics
and for children
and before
that perhaps,
they go into
secondary. My kids are, I tell them, the Windsors aren't as privileged. They're probably going, who are the Windsors? But they have education. They have two parents who will sit down whenever we have a minute. Yeah. But there are children out there that may never catch up. And maybe we need to start planning now for an optional seventh class or a kind of a transition year that the kids that have fallen behind are able to get to the level. So there's a level playing field for people.
Because I often think when we look at how so many businesses, say particularly food businesses and different people, have pivoted and innovated very quickly here, There's been a huge lack of innovation in our thinking or in our systems around this or anything.
We're just reacting all the time, like on the hoof. Yeah, we're reacting, and it's policy on the hoof, and it's sort of we didn't need to park life where we're doing this. But I would argue, and I do know there are some positive things in the HSE, and that some of the waiting lists have actually been eaten into out in City West. Some of the allergy clinics have, really been whittled down. But there's other versions of that that can be done, and we just need to think outside the box. You know, we have people for once dying to be tested for something, dying for information, and the level of interest. I have never seen, obviously, the level of interest and the level of expertise in the community from people. Yeah. People are so, and I don't say everyone's an immunologist now, but people do get it. They remember page one in biology in second year or whatever, or in for science for the juniors or how a virus, and they're really interested.
Yeah, I'd say you're a tough teacher.
I'm all right. I
wouldn't mind you by the time I was 10, but I'd say in high infants now it should be tough going. Jack Harding Jones.
I think that one of the big failures, and Kate has identified it very well, is the failure to kind of think strategically our way through this pandemic. And I think that is very much the case when it comes to schools, right? Because one of the big things that the government has trumpeted since September, since it's reopened, and has been the fact that we've managed to keep people in schools. And we know that it's a kind of article of faith for Micheál Martin. But while they made that a front and centre policy achievement,
and it worked very well for a while.
It worked very well, but they don't seem to have done any strategic thinking about what do we do if we have to close down schools, or what do we do if we can't open them up again. You know, so it comes to a point where all of a sudden we lose control of the disease after Christmas, and then we're thinking, right, how do we get the schools back? And you're trying to build the plane while you're flying it simultaneously. Mm. You know, and. You know, we've now gone twice up the hill on special needs kids going back to school. We're about to go a third time up the hill, and that's a very small chunk of a very big problem. And we don't seem to be able to solve these in real time. And I think it's a real ticking time bomb for the government, because people will run out of patience, capacity, and so on in terms of homeschooling.
Is there any potential strategy here? Like, is there anything that they could have done? I'm not being an apologist for them, but they do kind of remind when some journal or broadcaster is badgering them sometimes about why can't you do this better. They go, well, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and you know, we're reacting on the fly to an unpredictable thing.
Well, like most journalists, I have questions and not answers in front of them. I do think that the problem is when you kind of make these articles of faith out of policy, and you don't think about, well, what if something goes wrong? Yeah. Because there's a phrase that goes around: tell COVID you have a plan. And COVID will make a fool of that plan. You know, we should always be prepared for things going absolutely the wrong way. You know, and the unanticipated happening. It's almost as soon as you can imagine what might go wrong, a day later it's going wrong.
Okay, so while I see Kate O'Connell sticking to the curriculum strictly as a home teacher, are you that teacher who is opening up the windows of wonder for the child and encouraging critical thinking and everything? You strike me as that kind of teacher, are you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, she's a master's level in Peppa Pig now, a PhD in Bing, you know. So, I'm fortunate insofar as my daughter is 2.5, and so I'm not really facing those issues around curriculum. But certainly during the first lockdown and during part of this lockdown, we were dealing with the fact that, you know, she was at home and not in creche and both of us working full time, that's very challenging, and that's obviously something that's replicated in households up and down the country. And you'd wonder how sustainable it is, really.
Yeah. Kate mentioned there the notion of moving people up and down the vaccine list. And there's a piece there, right, Mark Tye in the Sunday Times today. I think the two Jacks, you were looking at that. The gold rush for COVID vaccinations. Jack Lambert, there is a lot. Everybody has a good claim to move up the list here, don't they? And like I was saying a few weeks ago, it's quarter two is going to be the real bun fight, isn't it? Because, well, assuming that we're roughly still on schedule, quarter one is fairly clearly defined as the people who kind of everyone agrees really need it. But quarter two is when it's more up in the air, and everybody wants in on that, don't they?
So absolutely. I think, you know, I mean, look, this is a huge challenge. And, you know, there's been some criticisms of the first rollout of the vaccines, you know, but there's been a limited amount of vaccine that will come into Ireland. You know, maybe 180,000 doses now to healthcare workers and to, you know, care facilities. But we need to half a million. You know, we need half a million coming every month, not 150,000. So we don't have control over how much vaccine is delivered to Ireland, but we do have control over our decisions. And we have to have really clear communication, I think, between the ministry, the government, and people who have boots on the ground, the clinicians, in terms of making those decisions, you know. And I think people shouldn't be jumping up, and the gold rush for COVID vaccinations is saying that people are jostling the queue. But I think you have to think very carefully ahead of time, you know, so that you don't get caught and criticized. And it's a huge challenge. I have people all the time coming up into me, asking me this, asking me that. So I think we have to put a very detailed plan together, including, you know, that using the clinicians with boots on the ground to look at all of the different groups, and then contingent upon how much vaccine comes along, based on times, have a detailed plan about who's going to get it. So that really is important to get that message right.
Yeah, and I think we're told there is a detailed plan. I know there's been a few skirmishes on the edges of the wrong people getting it, but largely it seems to be going to the right places. Jack Organ-Jones, you were looking at that Mark Tighe piece, but as well at a Tony O'Brien piece in the Business Post, We Need a Face and a Voice to Lead the Vaccine Rollout.
Yeah, and I think the Tony O'Brien piece in particular kind of goes to a lot of the issues that we're going to be facing into around people lobbying for earlier access to the vaccine and making their own case to get into that category six of key workers, which is kind of ill-defined and everyone has a good argument to be in. I think that part of the problem with the vaccine rollout so far, in addition to all the issues around Pfizer and now AstraZeneca, which are obviously kind of not unique to us and across Europe as well, is the fact that, like, you know, Who is really in charge? Ultimately, it's the Minister for Health, but operationally, it's the HSE. And then you have the expert group headed by Breon McCrae, which is a kind of good clearinghouse for all the different moving parts to come together and sit down and talk. But, like, there is an absence of a singular figure and a singular kind of communications point as well. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that we do need to have a vaccines minister, which is something that they do have in the UK, but I think you do need someone to talk to when you want to talk to Brussels or when you want to talk to Europe on this, you know, someone whose job it is to be the face and the voice of it.
And Breon McCrae is not that person.
I don't think he is quite, because he doesn't have, I think, executive power over these things. You know, I think that Breon is someone who kind of brings people around him and enables a kind of a dialogue to take place and enables some barriers to be broken down. But he's not overall responsible for the vaccine rollout program. Yeah. He's not chief of vaccinators, you know.
Okay. Kate, you're nodding. So
yeah, I think the person in charge has to have a clinical background, because my view would be that if the person rolling out the vaccine program had an insight into the operations of delivering a vaccine program, they would have anticipated what happened in the maternity hospitals. They would have anticipated people perhaps who, you know, weren't due a vaccine to get one. I do think, though, we need to look at, like, I mean, I'm due to be vaccinated, I believe, soon enough. I'm 41 now. 41-year-old with very little, I've no underlying condition. I would much prefer my sister-in-law, who's 40 with special needs, or my mother-in-law, who's 80, and I want to get her back working, to be vaccinated. So I do think the only risk in my life, because I'm behind Perspex and double-masked, is if an incident happens. So if there's a heart attack or a seizure or an anaphylactic reaction, then I can't keep 2 metres. But in general, community pharmacy, we don't have to be within company for 15 minutes less than 2 metres. We can avoid that. So I do think perhaps we need to, well, the community pharmacist is probably giving out now, but yeah. I do think that we need to look at it and go, isn't it so important that we vaccinate people who we need to get back to work, but also the people with additional needs, because it's such a spectrum, from a 5-year-old child perhaps on the autism spectrum to an adult, a large adult with special needs.
Okay.
It's a huge spectrum.
In terms of, just very briefly, in terms of from your standpoint as a pharmacist and everything, are you ready to rock and roll here? And, like, say if in April, which I believe is when Johnson & Johnson might be coming, one shot, no special, doesn't need any special freezing or anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if millions of them start coming in, you're ready to go? Are we ready to do 1 million a month of shots? If it's a two-shot thing, we're going to do
a million
a month.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Okay. I think we did the flu without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible, very possible.
Okay, let's take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Vision Express stores are open for all your eye care needs. So you can now book an eye test. And while we look after your eyes, we're looking out for your safety too by following social distancing measures and using personal protective equipment. Find your nearest store and book online at visionexpress.ie. We're open for you.
Your mental health is important, and now it's easier than ever to find the supports and services closest to you. You can free phone the Your Mental Health Information Line at 1800 111 888 anytime. Our team will tell you which supports and services are near you, where they are located, and how you can access them. You can also visit yourmentalhealth.ie for more information on mental health, for you or for people you know. Yourmentalhealth.ie. From the HSE.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Kate O'Connell, Jack Horgan-Jones and Dr. Jack Lambert. Listen, there's a text here and I do want to acknowledge this. Brendan, most secondary schools are doing live online classes following the school timetable. Please let this be acknowledged. Teachers are working, are following the curriculum and giving students support. And we absolutely...
And many primary school teachers.
Yeah. And primary school teachers are doing a great job. Yeah. And I think we absolutely do acknowledge that. Listen... We have tended to forget about business for the moment. In a way, it's almost as if it's been parked and we're just accepting that this is how it is. And I guess business are accepting it as well. But Jack, you were kind of in this area of business and everything. You don't feel there's a huge push from them to open up or anything. Where do you think business people are at with this?
Not imminently, no. Yeah. I think that, like, much as is the case with the rest of the population, I think that, you know, there's an acceptance that the current phase of level five we're in for the next kind of 4 weeks or perhaps even as much as 8 weeks. And I think that they're behind that. You might see a bit of lobbying to get some construction open next month, but I don't think there's going to be a kind of clamour from the IBEX of this world or anything to unlock anytime soon. I think they're kind of broadly behind it. But that being said, that doesn't mean that, you know, the very fundamental and real and existential problems that are being faced by businesses up and down the country have gone away. And I think that, you know, as and when we come out of this and as and when the CRIS schemes of this world are turned off, then you might see a real kind of carnage amongst SMEs, because many of them will have kind of run out of road and they'll have just spent so long with their doors closed that you will see a kind of wave of insolvencies in different sectors, and particularly in more acutely affected sectors like tourism and travel and transport. You know, there needs to be, and I think Natalie Riker is actually quoted in saying that there will be specific consideration given to how to relaunch the hospitality sector as and when that's possible in the next half of the year. Because so I think even from once we get the under control from a kind of epidemiological point of view, the recovery will be a whole kind of complicated policy piece in and of itself. And
might not be as simple as the roaring 20s at all. Jack Lambert, is it only right and proper that we just have to basically park all other aspects of life at the moment and just they have to be sacrificed? Business, etc.
Absolutely. With the numbers this high, it's just not, like I said, this is, I think I know cases of this virus spreading just from, you know, people cocooning at home where food was delivered to their house, you know. So even just contact with a surface, if you don't disinfect it.
Really? I mean, we're back to that fear, are we?
I think, you know, well, I'm just telling you, as I'm just telling you that there's this new virus is even more infectious. I think we actually, until we get the virus under control and have more meticulous COVID prevention plans up and running for the community, I'd just love to see, I go to the grocery store, I'd like to see 10 out of 10 people washing their hands going into the store rather than 2 of 10. I do these kind of little surveys every weekend when I do my once a week shopping. We're not getting it right. So we can't open it up. Right now we've got skeleton, you know, kind of services in the community, and people going into the community are not doing it right. It's not been enforced. We can't open up at the present time with the numbers so high. Yeah. And the ongoing search at the hospital.
Okay, Jack, thanks. And look, we're back to where we started there, which is that, you know, we've been doing this for a year, but that doesn't mean we can let up now. And you're saying we have to be even more careful. All right, listen, thanks, Dr. Jack Lambert. Thanks, Kate O'Connell. And thanks, Jack Horgan-Jones.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.